The internet certainly changed the doctor-patient relationship in medicine. Now when people go to see the doctor, they often have their own ideas about what might be ailing them, armed with pages of material from WebMD and similar sites. Well, the doctor-patient relationship could stand to change in other ways in the eyes of today's guest. He wrote a book about it called Snowball in a Blizzard, A Physician's Notes on Uncertainty in Medicine. Dr. Stephen Hatch is a medical doctor himself, an infectious disease specialist, currently working as an assistant professor at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center in Worcester. From UMass, we join Stephen Hatch. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
So is the book meant for physicians or patients or both?
It's meant for both. It's meant to be a consideration of the areas where we have strong knowledge about what we're doing, but more importantly, it's about areas where we're less certain and that those areas can sometimes be oversold in the public dialogue.
Give us a sense of what you emerged from medical school with in your time graduating and the people you're sending out now. It was there when you came out, this idea that you were going to be ready with the answer to every question?
Yeah, I think part of it is the weeding out process by which you get into medical school. You have to pass through college courses of biology and chemistry and physics, and the way in which most people get their grades in those courses is they have to answer questions correctly where there's only one right answer and everything else is wrong, and then you go and you take your MCATs and you go through the same process, and that process continues on through medical school where you take all these tests that really appraise knowledge by looking at a right answer versus multiple wrong options. And then you get out into practice and you discover the reality is actually much more complicated than that, where there's actually a variety of potential options by which patients and doctors might have reasonable differences of opinion as to what the best course to proceed is.
So is it considered bad form for a doctor to say, I'm not sure what I'm looking at here?
It very much depends on the situation, and it depends on the patient and their comfort level with a doctor saying that. I mean, I have said, not quite with that same sigh, but I've said, I'm not sure what's going on, and many patients greet that with relief because they feel like it's refreshing to know that there are doctors who can admit this. But I've also had patients who felt very uncomfortable with that, as if somehow that is an indicator of my lack of competence. And I've seen them do this with other physicians as well.
So some of the pressure is going to come from the training and some from the patients themselves.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So you have worked overseas. Is the focus on a pinpoint diagnosis a strictly American thing, or is that sort of a worldwide medical thing?
Well, what's interesting is my journeys abroad got me really to think about all of the technology we have here in the States. So I've practiced in places where really all you have is a stethoscope and your medical knowledge. And so there's a lot of guesswork that goes on when you're taking care of patients like that. And you would think that by returning to the States, where we have all these clinically precise tools, that we're in much better shape. And to a large extent, that is true. But what also happens is you realize that those tools that we have do not give us absolute certainty every single time. And the more I developed as a clinician, the more I realized that sometimes the technologies that we utilize, we have put a little bit too much of our faith into them.
So the central word here is uncertainty. It's right there in the subtitle of the book, A Physician's Notes on Uncertainty in Medicine. It's not welcome, I suppose, but can it be helpful?
I think so, and I think it's a reality whether we want it to be or not. And I think that by being aware that this phenomenon exists really across the spectrum in medicine, we're much more likely to make good decisions rather than make bad decisions. And throughout the book, I try to highlight certain instances where I think there are some downsides and some negative consequences to being overly sure about the technologies that we possess.
You present a spectrum of certainty in the book, which is a little hard to describe on the radio, but on one end you have benefit and on the other end you have harm, and on both ends you have high confidence and strong evidence. So I guess the real interesting zone that is in the middle then. What's going on between the poles here on the spectrum of certainty?
Yeah, so the idea that I had behind laying out the spectrum of certainty was to give people a sense of when medicine really, when a doctor looks you in the eye and says, I really think that this is going to benefit you, that you can have really pretty high degree of confidence that what they're saying is true. but that there's also things where a doctor's recommendation is much more speculative. A doctor's prognosis may be more speculative. A technology may have some ups, but it also may have some downsides to it as well. And that's where you start to hit the middle of the spectrum of certainty, where you have to start taking into account both risks and harms. And then as you emerge out onto the other side, there are times where a doctor's recommendation against something has a high level of confidence. And one of the points I try to make in the book is there's actually a lot of the technologies that we use today actually fit closer to the middle than is often popularly portrayed. There certainly are some things that we do in public health and medicine that really are far out to the left. One of the most important of which I talk about is vaccines. And I don't talk about it a lot in the book because other writers have done that. But as you start to move into other technologies, they become less beneficial, and there also are some downsides to those technologies.
So they're going to cause as much harm potentially, or have effects that can be negative to the patient as well as the things that are good for the patient?
That's exactly right.
Huh. How did Donald Rumsfeld end up in a book about medicine?
So Rumsfeld, of course, had the famous statement in Iraq when a reporter was trying to press him about the chaos that engulfed Iraq after the invasion. And Rumsfeld had this sort of off-the-cuff reply, which was, there are known knowns, there are known unknowns, and then there are unknown unknowns. And what I was thinking about as I was putting together the introduction to the book, that this might be a great way to explain what we know and what we're less certain of in medicine.
So these are the known unknowns we're talking about in Snowball in a Blizzard?
Mainly known unknowns, yeah.
All right, back to talk more with Dr. Stephen Hatch about Snowball in a Blizzard, a physician's notes on uncertainty in medicine, when we return to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Doctor, it hurts when I do this. Well, don't do this, the doctor says. That might be the easiest patient interaction ever, but the fact is, there's a lot of uncertainty in medicine, as Dr. Stephen Hatch points out in his book, Snowball in a Blizzard, A Physician's Notes on Uncertainty in Medicine. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about diagnosis and prognosis and how there's not 100% surety in either one of those. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So what is the meaning of the title, Dr. Hatch?
So Snowball in a Blizzard is a joke that radiologists have had for several decades about the difficulties of interpreting mammograms. We often think of the mammogram technology for screening for breast cancer as that women go in, they get the x-rays, and the cancer just shows up as an unambiguous item on the x-ray. And it turns out that it's actually much more difficult from separating cancerous tissue from normal tissue. And so the joke that radiologists have is, you know, trying to find a tumor on a mammogram is like trying to find a snowball in a blizzard.
Okay, we'll talk more about mammograms later on because there's a lot to talk about here. The first chapter, though, is about overdiagnosis. And I guess if you're a patient outside the medical realm, you're thinking, well, how can you overdiagnose? I want to know what's wrong with me.
So one of the real advances that we've made in medical technology, particularly radiology diagnostic technology, as well as many blood tests, is that they've become incredibly sensitive at picking up diseases in their earliest states. And that looks to be like nothing but an upside. But what people started to discover is they were doing epidemiology and research on various diseases is we saw during the 1990s and the 2000s a steady increase in the diagnosis of various diseases, and yet we weren't seeing corresponding benefits in terms of mortality or morbidity. And that led to the conclusion in many cases that we're diagnosing more cancers or more other kinds of diseases that look on the tests to be those diseases, but in fact they're not doing the person any harm. And so we have this area in which we're making these diagnoses with apparent certainty, but at a global scale, we're actually not benefiting patients.
That must be a tough one to try to teach to doctors in medical school where you work, the sense of, like, we have this new tool, it can pick up things in a much more sensitive way than before. However, we can't start assuming that everything we see is that thing.
Yeah, and this has been something that the medical community has gradually started to recognize over about the past decade, is people are becoming increasingly aware that we are doing more and more overdiagnosing, but we don't yet have a really great way to understand how to underdiagnose and diagnose less.
All right, so there's a great story in this chapter about overdiagnosis, about research with fake psychiatric patients done by Dr. Rosenhan. What did he do?
So Dr. Rosenhan, back in the late 1960s, was skeptical about the ability of psychiatrists to make diagnoses, and he wondered what would happen if he took a bunch of people who were completely normal without any problem, any psychiatric history, but had them come to hospitals and say that they had heard a voice, and the voice had just said three words to them: empty, hollow, and thud. And so this was a typical audio hallucination that can sometimes be seen in people with psychosis, but can also sometimes just be transiently experienced by people who don't have psychotic problems. And all eight of these people were admitted with very profound diagnoses of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder with schizophrenic features. And they were held for actually very long times. One of the patients was held for nearly 2 months. And they were regarded as being completely insane by not only the doctors who admitted them, but the staff who took care of them as well, even though they behaved perfectly normally while they were being hospitalized. He wrote that paper up in Science magazine, which is the premier scientific journal in the world, and that was really a sort of wake-up call for the psychiatric community. And for the most part, over the decades, people have always talked about the Rosenhan experiment through the lens of psychiatry. And what struck me as I was reading about it was that it's actually a story about diagnosis and not just psychiatry, and that you can actually apply the principles of overdiagnosing in the Rosenhan experiment to a much broader set of diseases. And what it tells you is that when doctors are primed to look for diseases, they start seeing diseases even in places where it doesn't exist.
The old, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail?
Absolutely.
Stephen Hatch is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Snowball in a Blizzard, A Physician's Notes on Uncertainty in Medicine. When you get to cancer diagnoses, you write of optical illusions. I mean, is this the newer equipment you're talking about where we're looking at things and go, ah, aha, there it is?
Yeah, the optical illusion that I talk about is in relation to prostate cancer, which is now slowly becoming, it's falling by the wayside, but it was very popular in the 1990s and the 2000s. And what I tried to make, and this is a tricky point to try to make on radio, is that if you took a group of men who weren't given the blood test that we were using to screen at the time, and we still use,
this is called PSA?
The PSA test, is that men were being screened for PSA, and several of those men were receiving a preliminary diagnosis of prostate cancer for which they got biopsies, and the biopsies showed them they had cancer, and then they were referred for treatment, and they were referred for sometimes chemotherapy, sometimes prostatectomy. And what happened was when they did the studies comparing men who had the blood tests to men who didn't, they found that there was at most one man out of 1,000 who had a life-saving benefit. But for that potential one man, and that's actually a debatable number, there were 20 extra men in the screened group who came down with a diagnosis of prostate cancer. And the optical illusion is that those 20 men had every reason to believe that the blood test picked up their prostate cancer and saved their life. But we know in population studies that that's not the case. And this kind of shows one of the dilemmas of overdiagnosis.
Was there no benefit to those 20 men? I mean, were they not, they did not in fact have prostate cancer?
That's right. Is what the studies would show is that if you didn't screen men, about 70 men in a 10-year period would come down with prostate cancer. But if you screened those same men, this is out of 1,000, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
But if you screened those 1,000 men, about 90 would be diagnosed with prostate cancer and undergo the treatments of prostate cancer, which includes surgery and chemotherapy and radiation. But if you compared the death rate of both of those groups, both groups would have 7 men who would die out of those 1,000 from prostate cancer, or maybe in the screened group, 6.
So the difference is negligible, you're saying, between using the PSA test and not, but it is still used, you say?
It is. There is no longer a hard recommendation for its use among any group. The American Urological Association, the last time I looked this up, which was a couple of months ago, has a recommendation that men ages 55 to 70 talk with their doctors about it, but they don't have a hard recommendation for it.
All right. So just for the benefit of those of us who own prostates, what is the usual recommendation for procedure once you pass 55?
The digital prostate exam. So the you go in for an exam, and the physician does a prostate exam on you, and then if they feel a lump or something abnormal, then you would be referred on for further testing. But now there is no longer a hard recommendation to use the PSA blood test.
Okay, I wanted to make sure we got a little specific on that as long as we were talking about it. Snowball in a Blizzard, A Physician's Notes on Uncertainty in Medicine is the book we're talking about with Dr. Stephen Hatch, who is a doctor himself and also teaches new doctors as an assistant professor at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center in Worcester, UMass Worcester. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 with your questions about medical procedures and diagnosis. 800-838-3760. By phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So now back to the title, Snowball in a Blizzard, which refers to the difficulty of seeing actual lumps or nodes in a mammography. I mean, mammography has been very hotly debated. Can you give us the capsule description of what's been going on the last few years?
Yeah, so my original interest in what would become this book started in 2009 when the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force came out with a set of guidelines on mammograms for women. And there were two recommendations that really started a firestorm in the public. One was that women under 50 were no longer advised to get annual mammograms. And previously, the recommendations had been that women starting at age 40 get mammograms and that they have them annually. The second recommendation they had was that women get mammograms every other year. And there was an enormous furor that took place at the time. And I was reading stories in the New York Times, and I was listening on NPR and catching the local news in Boston about the reaction. And it suddenly occurred to me that because I had training in clinical investigation and in learning how to read literature for study design, I didn't have to go through the normal media sources, that I could read the report directly, even though I didn't have a lot to do in my practice with doing mammograms. So I sat down and read that report. And what I learned was actually very surprising, which was, number one, there were some downsides to mammograms that people had not really talked about and that I didn't really understand when I was doing my training as a med student and a resident. And then secondly, the benefits of mammography, which I had been led to believe were on the order of the benefits that we perceive for vaccines, is actually much more modest. Most studies do show that there's a life-saving benefit to mammograms, although not all do. But the benefit that they show is fairly small. And just to give you a sense of the numbers, roughly speaking, about 10 women's lives are saved for every 1,000 mammograms performed over a 10 to 20 year span.
Okay. So, and then, but are you saying that with mammography, the results were not that much better than without mammography?
Well, so what most of the studies show is that benefit of about 10 lives saved for every 1,000 women over 10 to 20 years. And what had not really been popularized in the media and was not actually popularized even within the medical community is that for those 10 lives saved, what has to happen with mammograms is a lot of overdiagnosis takes place. And it depends on how you do the numbers and whether you get it every year or every other year and whether you start at 50 or whether you start at 40 or 45. But on somewhere in the range of 50 to 60 to 100 additional women get referred for biopsy. And of those women who are referred for biopsy, so nearly 10 times the number of lives that get saved, a certain percentage of those women get diagnosed with breast cancer that they don't actually have and go on to receive the treatment and the harms that come with it without any corresponding benefit. And so mammograms are actually a very thorny issue because they both carry a life-saving benefit by most studies, but they also carry the harms of a false positive diagnosis. And that was really the core of the debate and really remains the core of the debate today. But I don't think it was something that was well explained during the tempest that surrounded those 2009 recommendations. And 7 years later, it still remains a bone of contention. And not a lot of people really understand this, even in the public dialogue.
So what is the current recommendation? Is it still every other year past a certain age?
So it really depends on which recommendation you want to follow. So there are competing organizations that have different recommendations. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, which was an appointed arm of the Department of Health and Human Services of the federal government, still has affirmed those previous recommendations of that women after 50 should start and should have them every other year. For women under the age of 50, there's not a strong recommendation against it. They have a little bit of a hedge and say that there can be certain reasons why some women might select it, such as genetics or a family history, but it's not a hard recommendation for it. The American Cancer Society has recently changed its recommendation to start at age 45, and then there are some other groups that have different recommendations.
We're talking to Dr. Stephen Hatch about his book, Snowball in a Blizzard, A Physician's Notes on Uncertainty in Medicine. There's this line in the chapter about mammography that really kind of brings things home. You say, even accurate tests have lousy predictive value when applied in the wrong population, meaning as you're talking about mammography, you got to make sure you're giving them to the right people?
Yeah, that really was the essence behind the Preventive Services Task Force not recommending it for women under 50. The problem is that even in a test that's 99% accurate, there are about 20 million women from the ages of 40 to 50. So if you have a 99% accurate test, that means 1% out of 20 million women are going to have a false positive mammogram. That comes out to 200,000. And the number of women who have invasive breast cancer between the ages of 40 and 50 is 50,000. So that means out of 250,000 positive mammograms that would be read if you gave every woman a mammogram in that age range, you would actually have, for every actually positive mammogram, you would have 4 falsely positive mammograms.
Okay, which is not what you want by any stretch. Let's take a call. We have Jim in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Stephen Hatch.
Yes, good morning. This is something I've been kind of barking about for quite a while. The medical profession has turned too much like the legal profession. You either prosecute or you defend, and then when a decision is to be made on the court, it's always based on prior decisions, as you say, of other groups, of other things.
Like looking at legal precedent
in courts is often used, but nobody counsels anybody about why things happened. You know, That's what I'm seeing in medical things.
All right. Well, either or. Thanks for that, Jim. Appreciate it. Thoughts on that, Dr. Hatch?
Thanks for your thoughts, Jim. I agree that one of the potential problems that we have is when we give hard recommendations as opposed to counseling, which is the word that he used. And I really feel like one of the things that we need to start thinking about in the doctor-patient relationship is that we counsel rather than we just give hard and fast recommendations. Because I think that, for instance, when we talk about mammograms, that some women may listen to that data and say, I absolutely want to have a mammogram at, say, age 47 and have it annually. I can also imagine some women who would look at that data and say, you know, I don't think I need that. And our job isn't to steer them one way or the other in a strong way. Our job is to try to get them to understand the size of the benefit and the size of the risks.
Specifically with something like mammograms, though, I mean, how much would you take family history, for example, into account?
Well, that's an interesting question. We don't yet know with a great deal of certainty how strongly family histories can influence. So, for instance, we know that there are certain genetic mutations in a gene called the BRCA1 that strongly increase a woman's risk. However, what we don't know is whether there would be any life-saving benefit to prophylactic mastectomy, which is something that some women do. We haven't actually performed the studies over time to know whether that actually benefits women or not.
So it seems like on a large scale, not just within individual doctor-patient relationships, but there are a lot of things we're still learning. We haven't gotten it knocked by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Much more to talk about with Dr. Stephen Hatch. The book is Snowball in a Blizzard, A Physician's Notes on Uncertainty in Medicine. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Hatch and your phone calls and emails in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about medicine and its conduct and the doctor-patient relationship, diagnosis, prognosis, and more are the focus of the book Snowball in a Blizzard, A Physician's Notes on Uncertainty in Medicine. How often the doctor does not say, I don't know, and perhaps should. You can join us on the exchange as we talk about this with Dr. Stephen Hatch, who is himself a physician and teaches new doctors at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center in Worcester. Phone number here, 800-838-3760. Email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the exchange. What's on your mind?
Yes, good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, Dr. Hatch. A question and a comment, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Hatch, what is the place of medical insurance in this escalation of overdiagnosing and hence causing having one of the best medical systems in the world, but it costs too much for a lot of people? And the question is, what do you think about the nature of a second diagnosis, a second opinion, so to speak, and wouldn't that kind of like get another cook involved maybe, but maybe the soup isn't as bad as it is because we haven't put enough salt in it, if that makes any sense.
All right, a little mixing metaphors there, but we got the idea. Thanks for that, Jamie. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your questions, Jamie. So the first question that you have about medical insurance is not something that I tackled in the book. One sort of hidden secret about doctors is that most of them do not know the ins and outs of a lot of insurance reimbursement. Partly that's because different patients have different kinds of medical insurance, and so to know all the different reimbursement schemes is actually very, very complex. That being said, I think that insurance payers are probably paying attention to this within populations, and that's a subject really for another book that I hope to write someday. The question about second opinions, I've gotten several of these questions as I've come out with the book, and one thing that I want to emphasize is that second opinions, particularly in situations where the level of uncertainty is fairly high about a diagnosis or a treatment plan, and simultaneously, the how high the stakes can be. Second opinions are things that should very much be sought out by patients and their families, and that doctors should encourage second opinions. I generally think that when a patient comes to me and says, "Doc, I want to take a look, you know, from a fresh set of eyes," I think that that's a very reasonable thing, because sometimes somebody looking at a problem in a different way may have a different take that can be useful for a patient. So part of the issue of uncertainty is being comfortable with letting patients go and find other opinions.
I'm not surprised to hear you say it's hard to follow all the different ways in which insurance companies reimburse, but the fact is they're going to make differences in how the patient is able to move, because if a patient will not get funded by his or her insurance company for searching that second opinion, they're sticking with you as number one.
Yeah, so like the one issue with respect to insurance reimbursement I can talk about is the mammogram issue, because the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force was originally created during the Reagan administration when some of these screening technologies were coming online and insurance companies were not reimbursing them. And so the Department of Health and Human Services wanted to create a task force to really say to insurance companies, no, these things actually save more money in the long run for the medical system. What's interesting about the 2009 recommendations to that women not under the age of 50, that they don't have to have mammograms, is that the U.S. Senate included an amendment in the Affordable Care Act basically overriding that recommendation so that women under the age of 50 can have their mammograms covered. So that's actually one of the issues where the insurance companies do cover something that is controversial.
You know, the blow up over mammograms, as you point out in the book, is knitted together with concern about media coverage. What do you take issue with in the way the news was reported on the mammogram study issue?
Yeah, I think for me, the part that I felt the media missed in that story was the story was portrayed as doctors want less for you. And given that particularly women have not always done so well at the hands of a mostly male medical profession over the centuries, it was an easily understood message. And the subtext was, you know, doctors want less for you. They don't care about you as women. And half of the task force was actually comprised of women. And that part of the story didn't get out. And I think the message that was missed is that the task force had really uncovered that there are some harms that are associated with mammograms. And so women's bodies could actually end up being harmed as a consequence of too many mammograms. And that just never got relayed in the public dialogue. And it isn't that difficult a message to explain.
No, it's not. I think you got it pretty well in about half a sentence there. And then you go on to talk about, in the chapter on media, the Berlin patient. I mean, whole books reported about this person who it looks like HIV left his body. What happened there and what was misunderstood in the media?
Yeah, the story of the Berlin patient, which came out around 2010, was that there was this man who had HIV infection and he got a bone marrow transplant new cells, the cells that were transplanted into him, had a genetic mutation that made them resistant to HIV infection. And as a consequence, he has completely been cured of HIV. And it made, a little bit like the mammogram story, made a huge amount of news at the time. What wasn't getting reported was, first of all, how rare that is from a genetic standpoint to have a donor who's a perfect match, who happens to have those HIV-resistant cells, because those patients are very rare in the world overall that are truly resistant to HIV. And the second thing is, a bone marrow transplant is a very dangerous procedure. It's a procedure that carries a high mortality, and that the reason why the Berlin patient, a man named Timothy Ray Brown, was given this transplant is because he had leukemia, so that was the treatment for leukemia. But we wouldn't do that for a healthy person with HIV. And what we do now for patients with HIV is we give them pills, and those pills actually drive the viral load down to zero. And effectively, as long as patients take their pills every single day, they're functionally cured of HIV. But I was working at the time, and my office got hit with a large number of calls, you know, from people who were asking to have this treatment, and nobody was really out there explaining that this was very much an experimental therapy.
Well, you know, the chapter itself gives me a little bit of a little uneasiness, because it's called the Health Watch: Hype, Hysteria, and the Media's Overconfident March of Progress. I can remember well being told to change the name of a segment within a newscast from House Calls to Medical Breakthroughs. to make it sound all bold and exciting, which is one of the major points I think you're making, is that we get these things in the headlines every day. This study says you should do this now. This study says you should do that now. And then about 2 months later, something else comes out and says essentially the opposite, or so it seems. I mean, how do we as consumers of news look around this and try to find the real stuff behind it?
Be suspicious of overstatement. I actually think that that's just a simple rule to apply to everything that you hear, because one of the challenges I had when I was writing that chapter is, you know, how do I leave patients, and especially people who are outside, the medical profession, not feeling helpless of, like, what on earth am I going to do if Dr. Hatch says, you know, well, be skeptical. And I really think that the piece that is useful is if you hear a phrase like game changer, you should automatically, red flags should be going up, because that gets used all the time. Breakthrough, game changer, this is going to change everything. And one story or one study only on extremely rare occasion actually proves to be a game changer. So if you hear something like that, it's probably overstatement.
Now, in situations where you get things that are of concern on a large scale, you bring up MERS in the book. I think Ebola happened right after you finished writing it. Are there just some days that you hide from the news coverage?
Yeah, frequently. I think MERS was coming out as I started writing the chapter on media, and then so as I was writing it, I was like, look at all what we're seeing with MERS. And then as that year progressed and I continued doing other writing, the Ebola outbreak in 2014 had started, and that dominated world news headlines for, you know, 4 to 5 months. And what I wrote in a footnote to the book is, I said, you know, like, the Ebola outbreak has come and gone, and who knows what's going to be the next terrifying virus of 2016. And I was actually very pleased at my prescience of that, because Zika showed up on the scene almost exactly when the book got released. And I was like, here you go. Here's the latest kid on the block of, you know, viruses that induce a huge amount of anxiety. And Zika is not anywhere nearly as deadly as either MERS or Ebola. And yet there was just, you know, everybody was talking about it in January.
So the information and how we deal with it aside, I mean, you get to some really broad concepts in the book, too. And you say that there are dual narratives. Medicine is good and medicine is bad. And yet you say they're both right on some level. How?
So what I'm trying to point out, especially in the media coverage, is that you will read stories about the disaster that is modern medicine, and you'll hear about some patient who had a horrible outcome. And sometimes those stories are true related to the patient, but is not necessarily true overall. And then there are times where you'll read about some great new space-age technology in one of these new breakthroughs that gets heralded on these health segments, that really is overstatement and overselling. But there are some actually amazing things that we do in modern Western medicine. And so what I try to do is make people aware that both of those narratives that we carry around in our head, you know, the narrative of the medical disaster, as well as the noble profession of medicine, both of those can color our thinking and make us interpret data, or it can make us misinterpret data.
You mentioned vaccines in passing, but they're always an issue, it seems like. And there's been another blow up just this week with the removal of the film about Vaxxed, or I think it is, or Outvaxxed or something from the Tribeca Film Festival. So this is something that must be of major concern to you in the medical profession.
Yeah, that I noticed the headline about that, but I didn't read the story. The issue that I point out about vaccines, and I don't do a lot of discussion on vaccines because so many other people have written such great stuff about it, but from my point of view, it highlights something that a professor at the University of Washington named Leah Ceccarelli called the medical manufacturiversy. Which is that, you know, that are these manufactured controversies that are exacerbated in the media, where fringe opinions tend to dominate. And to me, the poster child for this are vaccines, because there's really very little disagreement within the mainstream medical community that vaccines not only are life-saving, but really probably are the single greatest triumph of modern medicine. And yet people think that there is a raging debate within the community, and there really is not. And there's plenty of things within the medical community that are controversial, of which mammograms is one prime example.
So just in terms of patient conduct, I mean, you're certainly counseling people who are going to become physicians on your end of things at the UMass Medical Center in Worcester. What should we as patients be doing to be a better part of a conversation with a doctor where there is uncertainty?
I think they should, that patients and doctors both should be talking to one another, or rather with one another, rather than at one another. And in order to do that, it's helpful to get medical news from obviously higher quality sources is always a help. And you mentioned at the very beginning of the show the internet, and I think the internet is one of the great tools of helping this new doctor-patient relationship, because patients can really find in a couple of clicks, they can really get themselves up to speed on certain kinds of diseases. And from my standpoint, not every doctor agrees with me on this, but from my standpoint, patients can become informed in a way that I can then help use my expertise to help shape that opinion and help them make decisions that are useful for them.
So if they come in with at least a rudimentary understanding of what they might be facing, they can at least have a more informed conversation with you.
Yeah, I think so. And instead of resisting that and saying, you know, no, I'm the expert, just listen to me, but rather to say, yeah, you know, that's a really great article that you looked up, and here's why I think that is useful or where the limitations are.
The book is called Snowball in a Blizzard, A Physician's Notes on Uncertainty in Medicine. Dr. Stephen Hatch wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
All right, good to have you.